Hello and welcome to the Tyndale House podcast. We're working to make high-level Bible research available to you to help you understand the Bible more and explore reasons why the Bible can be trusted. Tyndale House is an international centre for Bible research and a community of Christian Bible scholars in Cambridge, England. This series is a re-release of the Reading the Old Testament series, which was made in collaboration between Tyndale House and the Bible Society in 2022. In this series, Andrew Ollerton meets with five researchers to ask how they read, wrestle with, and still really enjoy the Old Testament text. We explore how they read the text and make sense of the tricky issues. In this first episode of the series, Andrew talks to Dr. Peter Williams, principal of Tyndale House and author of Can We Trust the Gospels and the Surprising Genius of Jesus? They discuss talking animals, Jacob's strange breeding program, and how we respond to parts of the Old Testament that seem odd. Please note this episode does contain a brief mention of sexual violence.
Well, welcome to this podcast series on trusting the Bible. This is actually season two, and we're digging into some of those unusual Old Testament texts. Today, it's great to be joined by Dr. Pete Williams, who is principal of Tyndale House in Cambridge, a good friend. Pete, it's great to have you with us today.
Great to be with you.
And Pete, we're going to dig into particularly some of those slightly unusual, strange, weird, dare say freaky incidents in the Old Testament where there are passages we don't understand, maybe talking donkeys or various passages where animals feature. Actually, that might be one of the common themes today. We'll see how we go with that. But before we get to those kind of interesting scenarios, I've got a few questions for you. Could you just briefly tell us, you know, what is your day job? What does life look like for you as a researcher at Tyndale House?
Well, I've got a phenomenally varied job. So I get to study, research, write, but also share those things with people, both individually and with larger groups. I get to lead an institution, sometimes plan what we're going to do and to travel with that. So, yeah, I have a very enjoyable job overall.
Yeah, sounds good. Now, if that job was no longer available and all things were possible, what else, what would you have done if you hadn't have gone into academia and biblical research?
Well, I think I might well have ended up teaching in some capacity. I mean, I do enjoy sharing things with people. So perhaps that, I don't know. But I certainly enjoy researching.
Okay, fair enough. Nothing very exotic then. Like, you know, no, not an astronaut or an international football player or something.
Well, of course. I mean, yeah, I wanted to be an astronaut like for the very early years of my life and then a concert pianist until I realized it wasn't good enough at age 16. And then a Bible translator, in fact, I did have in my eyes for quite a few years, yeah.
Very good. And if you could sit down to have coffee with someone, a character in the Old Testament, who would that be?
Oh, I think Abraham. I mean, I just think he is a remarkably big figure, the father from all of all these great nations, and the one person who's called a friend of God. Now, that's pretty remarkable. Mm. And I think going on there that God is only said to have one friend, but he does an awfully good job on the friendship. And one of the key things about friendship is that you share your plans. And so he shares his plans with Abraham. That's what he does. So yeah, I'd love to chat to him.
Well, let's zone in on Old Testament, and particularly today, Old Testament narratives that have some unusual features. Before we get into some specific examples, just, you know, share a bit with us, you know, what is it? You've been obviously reading and studying and enjoying the Old Testament and researching it. So you're trying to keep alive, I imagine, both an academic brilliance, but also a personal passion. You know, what is it about the Old Testament that, you know, inspires you, that you find compelling?
Well, I do think it is brilliant and sort of beats any literature in terms of the depth, the fact that you can go on seeing new things, just the layers that there are in there. So, and the difficulties there are part of the fun, part of the challenge. If you had a set of books with no difficulties and you just read them all and it was all just there, plain sight, first time through, well, it wouldn't really want you make you want to read it again. So I do think that it's just very engaging and extremely relevant. The sort of soap opera you have of the characters in there just parallels so many situations we have in the modern world.
Hmm. I want to come back to that relevance point in a minute. Before I do, though, I've heard you teach in another setting, Pete, about how God has ordained it that the Bible, if you like, is littered with traps, you might call them, or setups that almost by virtue of the fact that it's not straightforward, it draws out the seeker. Seek and you will find, but it also causes others to stumble. And so that is your teaching, isn't it, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, why on earth did Jesus choose Judas to look after the money of the disciples? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't double, you know, bookkeeping. It was just one guy. So he has the opportunity to dip his hand in the till. And in a sense, get a taste for what it is to get money. And I think what we've got to recognize is that life is morally structured. And it comes to us so that if you seek God, you will find him. And if you don't seek, you will stumble. Mm. And the Bible's like that. Mm. If you come to it not looking for God, you'll find all sorts of reasons not to believe in God in the Bible. And if you come looking for God, you'll just find abundant reasons to believe.
Mm. Now, I really appreciate that. And I've seen you unpack that, particularly in the Gospels. I'm putting you on the spot here a bit, but are there examples in the Old Testament that come to mind where you think it's equally applicable, that here you have a passage, a story, whatever, where it almost is a filter for the seeker and those who will stumble?
Well, I mean, you have the plagues in the book of Exodus, where for the Israelites, they're a sign of liberation, and for the Egyptians, they're not. But they steadily build up, and each time Pharaoh's given a chance to repent. But because the plagues ratchet up slowly, he also, the level of his heart's hardness is going up at the same time. So when it really comes to the crucial point, he's making the wrong decision. So I do think that that's the sort of way life works. People get opportunities to say yes to God, and often they're successively hardening themselves.
Mm. And of course, that is really refreshing to hear from someone. You're noted for your academic, you know, endeavors and brilliance, but obviously the thing you're drawing out here is there's a moral quality to how we interpret scripture, right? And that actually it's not just the sheer contest of IQ. It's going to come down to a sort of moral endeavor, a moral desire for God.
Yeah, and I think that's quite relevant for those who are called Christian apologists. A Christian apologist is someone who often tries to give people reasons to believe. And sometimes they can act as if everything is just overwhelmingly in their favor, and so everyone should immediately agree, and not really take into the point the fact that humans are humans. That human nature is just overriding. And they're all at different points in a relationship or escape from God. Mm. And that is absolutely key to how people read things.
Mm. Very good. Well, we're going to home in now on how do we take the Old Testament seriously, and particularly some texts where, as I say, I've not really thought about this, even as I was preparing for the podcast, but it's often featuring animals. Maybe there's something to comment on there. But, you know, there are some texts, and we're going to go to one with Jacob and some lambs and goats and issues around flocks. But before we get there, let's just visit a couple of other famous texts where you sort of, you know, as a Christian wanting to take the Bible seriously, you read, for example, you know, Elisha, the young lads who come and mock him, and then he calls down judgment and some she-bears come out of the woods, you know, and destroy and kill the boys, it seems. And then you get another story with Balaam's donkey talking. You get Lot's wife, actually that hasn't got an animal in it, but Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt. I mean, comment on any of those you wish, but they all sound fantastical to us, don't they? They all sound fictional, mythological. How do you take that seriously? And what does it mean to be confident when we read those kinds of texts?
Well, firstly, they are really, really rewarding to study. So that passage in 2 Kings chapter 2, where Elisha is at a place called Bethel, a house of God, where previously God had appeared to Jacob, and they shout to him, "Go up, you bald head." That's really what they're shouting. Mm. Now, there's a whole context for this, which is namely that Elisha's mentor, Elijah, has just gone up in the story in a chariot into heaven. So these children, whatever their age, are old enough to mock him in terms of asking for a repeat of that miracle. They are doing that at a point where God's revealed himself in a place called Bethel. And it's also fitting within a big narrative going all the way back to Leviticus chapter 26, where there's a set of curses if the Israelite adults don't obey God. And if they don't obey God, what's going to happen is wild beasts are going to kill their kids. And so all of that is happening. And you can bring it together and you can say, so this isn't a question of like just blaming the kids. Actually, this passage really blames the adults for the atmosphere that they're setting for their kids. But then you have to read it in the story of the whole Bible, that Elisha has a lot of parallels in his life with Jesus. But what does Jesus do with the kids? He blesses them. Elisha curses them, and Jesus blesses them. And again, you know, how does the Old Testament end in? Well, in Malachi, it's Elijah coming, and it ends on the word curse. The whole repent or God's going to strike the world with a curse. But in fact, what you find is along comes Jesus and there's blessing. So you've got to look at the entire narrative, not just one narrow bit that's going on. Because I think it's a bit like with, say, a Harry Potter series. You could pick out one particular bit of Dumbledore's behavior at one point and think that he's really an outrageous moral monster. But you've got to take the whole lot and suddenly see, no, it makes a lot more sense.
So that's a big, big sort of text in context point. Ultimately, but now, and at the same time, let me push you on a couple of even more challenging, problematic texts, because of course, you know, we're not unfamiliar today, regardless of how well we think we've organized the world. There are moments where animals assert their aggression and remind us that we haven't tamed the wild. So, you know, an attack by a polar bear or grizzly bear, that's still an event that makes sense to us, even if the Elisha incident has a spiritual interpretation to it. But you get these moments, for example, Balaam's donkey, where the donkey seems to stand in his way and speak to him, address the prophet Balaam, prevent him from delivering his oracle. And of course, maybe comment on that one first, but of course then the other talking animal in the Bible is way back in Genesis 3 with this seeming snake or serpent that slithers into the garden and speaks. So start with the Balaam's ass one. But my point is, this doesn't happen today. None of us other than in the Chronicles of Narnia have come across talking animals, and we don't live there. So what's going on?
Yeah, so I think firstly, it's really important to recognize that there are two and only two talking animals in the narrative of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so that takes it away from it sort of just a normal mythological corpus or fantastic beast and where to find them or wherever it is. You've just got these two. And what goes on? Well, in Genesis chapter 3, the serpent, the snake, the most proverbially clever animal, tells untruth. And in the passage in Numbers about Balaam, the donkey, the most proverbially stupid animal, tells the truth. And when does he tell the truth? He tells the truth to Balaam, who is a prophet or a seer. He's a guy who's supposed to see everything. So he certainly should see that invisible angel, because he's supposed to have all this special insight. And guess what sees the angel and he doesn't? It's the stupid donkey. And so I think you've got very important messages at these two points. And, you know, if you want to say, well, I can't believe the Bible because I struggle in believing a donkey spoke. The funny thing is, the laugh's actually on you. Because, you know, this is high comedy, where the cleverest person, and Balaam, his existence is mentioned outside the Bible in a text that's found in an area similar to where he comes from, which is plastered on the wall, the Deir Allah inscription. That's DEIRALLA.
Where's that located, Peter? Where was that found?
Just on the east of the Jordan.
Uh-huh.
And he's a real guy, and he's supposed to be incredibly clever. And so here we have the wisest person shown to be stupid by the proverbially stupid and somewhat hilarious donkey. So I think there's a lot going on there that's quite rich and edifying.
I totally agree about the, I mean, when you interpret it that way, and you're right, the fact that the donkey sees what the seer doesn't is all part of the comedy value. But as the donkey speaks, and in terms of the, well, no, just stick on that one. Are you saying then that you think that that actually happened? This isn't a narrative where a layer of meaning has been added in terms of a donkey speaking, that really what the narrator's saying is it's as if the donkey spoke, you know, because he gave such a strong message to the prophet not to continue. You think he actually spoke?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the key things about the narrative is it's got the servant going along with Balaam. So one of the points you have is actually to make sure there are enough witnesses to validate this. So it's quite interesting that you have that going on in the narrative, that actually it's quite concerned in, this is Numbers 22 verse 22. There's lots of twos there. 22:22 tells you there are two servants with him. So why does it give you that detail? Precisely because you need two or three people to validate testimony. So I do think that the narrative is telling you this happened.
Okay, so we put that in the category, really, of just a miracle, a supernatural event involving an animal, of which there are plenty in the Bible, right?
Yeah, and, well, you know, if you believe God can make the world, make things out of nothing, then that's not a big problem. The problem can be that doesn't relate to my experience. It's just too different. But the Bible isn't telling you that it does. The Bible isn't telling you that this is normal at all. It's quite abnormal. It's only when you get the supposedly cleverest person around at the time that this particular stunt comes out, if you like.
Very good. Now, listen, we're going to come into Genesis 30 now. We've chosen a particular text to, I suppose, just really kick around your approach to handling those passages where there seems to be strange things going on, at least from our perspective. So I'm going to just summarize it and then really just allow you to reflect on, you know, what is going on in this passage. And how do we almost begin to interpret something that's got unusual qualities to it? So the story here, this is Genesis 30. Our listeners may want to turn to it if you're not driving as you're listening. So Genesis 30, verse 25 to 43 has this account where after the birth of Joseph, Jacob asks his father-in-law, Laban, if he can now go home, right? So he's finally had the child, Joseph, with his favored wife, Rachel. Now he wants to go home. Now, Laban, her father, doesn't want Jacob to leave. He realizes that God's blessing has come on his flocks and his estate because Jacob is with him, which very much fulfills the Abrahamic promise, doesn't it? Through you, I'll bless those who bless you, and so forth. So this is an impartation blessing. So he asks him to stay. And Jacob, therefore, being the cunning man that he is, says, well, for every speckled or spotted sheep or every black or dark colored lamb, and goats, he wants those to be taken as his payment from Laban's flocks, and Laban can have the rest. So Laban agrees, separates out the speckled from the rest, but as Jacob is left with Laban's flocks, he then, and this is the bit that's a bit unusual, he peels off, doesn't he, some tree branches, I think poplar trees, he peels them off, the bark, places them around the watering troughs, and somehow it's thought that through that, the sheep that mate near those branches, and he chooses the moment when the strong are mating, that they then give birth to streaked or speckled or spotted lambs. Jacob siphons those off. He ends up not only with many, but the strongest, the best, most virulent of the flock. And that's the sort of narrative at which point, you know, Jacob offers quite a different explanation for why that's happened then later on in chapter 31. So there's lots going on here, but I think, Pete, My headline question is, you know, there seems to be this unusual approach to breeding that doesn't make sense to the biology that we understand today. How do you handle this kind of text?
Well, I think, firstly, it's incredibly relevant because it's just like the situation we're in today, where what you get, even in the way people handle a pandemic, is a mixture of science and, you know, folk remedies. So I think what you've got going on here is a mixture of things, and it's a wonderful thing to study at sort of an interdisciplinary level. It'd be lovely to have some geneticists helping us with this. But clearly, God blesses Abraham and blesses Isaac and blesses Jacob, not just through the techniques that they adopt. They are just blessed independent of that. And when you have this narrative in Genesis 30 describing what happened in simple terms, in addition to that, you've got to take into account two speeches where Jacob describes what happens. Firstly, when he's talking to his wives and talks in Genesis 31, verse 8, where he says, you know, that Laban was changing his wages all the time. And if he said the spotted shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore spotted. And if he said the striped will be your wages, then the flocks bore striped. He says something similar to Laban later on. He says that to Laban's face, he says, "You've changed my wages 10 times." So clearly, there's a more complex situation going on behind this. But even in antiquity, people did know about selective breeding. So there is a sense in which people don't understand genetics, but they do know that they have enough experience in breeding that there is some input from the colors of sheep or goats that you put together and what pops out. You don't have to be a genius to spot that. I mean, you can see it with dog breeding or all sorts of other things. So even though Laban puts all of Jacob's dark and spotted sheep 3 days' journey away, of course, when Jacob then starts tending this entirely white flock, we know that there are ways in which some of the darker signs are going to start coming out and they can be bred with. So my take on the stick stuff is that that's just purist superstition. And so you've got a mixture of, if you like, the science of some clever interbreeding and the right time and using strong animals and so on, together with some superstition. And then on top of that, you've got just God's blessing on Jacob. So however much his father-in-law Laban tries to diddle him and cheat him, it's not going to work. And so I think all of that's in the mix, as it often is. And this is what I love about these stories, the fact that they have this mixture. And that's usually what's going on when we look at our COVID graphs. They're rarely simple. They're usually a mixture. And you think, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? That's all going on. And so I think stories like this can be very helpful in telling you life's not simple. And you have to read them for what God's doing in this.
Yeah.
And God can even use superstitious things as part of his entire framework of saying, hey, Jacob's going to be blessed.
Yeah, and in that sense, God didn't use the superstition, but the superstition was merely a false explanation for a deeper blessing, right? So that there is selective breeding is a verifiable human technique and divine blessing, if you like, is a spiritual reality, the superstition element is almost just it potentially obscures us to what's really going on, right?
No. I actually really like the superstition. So for instance, God uses all sorts of things. So the fact that Isaac has a favorite son, Esau, and his wife Rebekah has a favorite son, Jacob. God uses her unfair favoritism to get Jacob in a position where he then tricks Esau and therefore gets the blessing. And so I think that God is using all sorts of things, like he can use the Assyrians, he can use the Romans, he can use the Egyptians, all sorts of stuff. So I don't see any reason why he can't use superstition as well.
Or at least he can work through the techniques attributed to what is now known to be superstitious. But in
I mean, maybe use is a bit of a blunt term, because at the end of the day, God's relationship with the way the universe works is complex. His ways are past finding out. I don't want to present him as just like pulling strings in a sort of mechanical way.
I'm trying to protect your reputation for orthodoxy here, Pete, but I'm sure that's long since not been intact, right? Anyway, that's really helpful. I think when you've unpacked it that way, I love the way you just sort of went into this incredibly obscure text about, you know, breeding sheep and saying this speaks to our times. And I'm sort of thinking, go on, persuade us. But you know, when you unpack it the way you have, you're right, it does. And in not least, it's another example in scripture of two chapters next door to each other, one of which is giving, if you like, the explanation in the realm of human agency. This is what Jacob did. But then in chapter 31, actually, Jacob's honest that he had, you know, an appearance of the angel of the Lord. And actually, he is attributing now to God's agency, not his own, the blessing of his flocks over Laban's, right? So that it's once again a text that reminds us there's always more going on than just what we're doing. And the Abrahamic blessing upon Jacob's life is the ultimate explanation for what's going on here.
Yeah, and I think, look, sometimes some of the best discoveries are made by mistake. And you literally take a wrong turn and you discover something really interesting. So I don't see why we should think that, you know, God only uses optimal techniques to bring about his preferred ends.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, Pete, just drawing this, if you like, we've gone in. We've gone in. I think of this this podcast like an hourglass, right? We've funneled into a particular text. I want to just pull out from it now and think, okay, how does the conversation we've had, how does that help our listeners when they are stumbling across a passage that seems to have a narrative passage, especially? So let's handle narrative genre, but a narrative passage where there seems to be, if you like, unusual things going on. What sort of tips do you have for, and earlier on, and so the both things at once here, really, but earlier on you spoke about the surprising relevance of these Old Testament passages. And I think you've demonstrated in the conversation we've had, you can, the strangest, most obscure text speaks today, but what are you doing? What are the sort of, show your workings, you know, what are the principles that help everyone get to that place of relevance and understanding?
Well, I think there are a few things. One is read the text lots of times, carefully. Another one is read it in fellowship with other people and sort of bounce ideas off them. Another one is not to shy away from problems. The problem may be the solution. It may be just allowing yourself to sort of go with the flow. Let's try this thing out. We'll actually solve it. Don't expect the people in the Old Testament to be blameless. A lot of the time, the narrative has its own logic, if you like, where people get what they deserve. So it's not telling you, oh, it's really good that these people have multiple wives. No, every single time people have multiple wives, there's lots and lots of family conflict. So this is actually telling you that this is not good. And when Lot offers his virgin daughters to the mob to be raped, well, in the logic of the narrative is he ends up having non-consensual sex with his two daughters. So in other words, the thing that he was planning on them comes back on him. And so those sorts of things are going on the whole time. And so it's having your eyes attuned to that.
In other words, with the narratives, they may not tell you what's right or wrong. It's like that, there's a line in the film industry, you know, showing, not telling, isn't it? And I often think, is that what you're saying?
So there's basically only about one point in the entire biblical narrative where it tells you that it was wrong, and that's David's adultery with Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. And that is in order to put a peg into the ground so that no one could possibly think that that was okay because he was his king. But if you work out from that, you can see all sorts of other things that have been done wrong. And all sorts of doubt. The heroes are anti-heroes in a lot of ways, and they are foils so that when you see Christ, you see, wow, that's what perfection looks like. So they with all their foibles, their weaknesses, it actually just puts Christ in greater relief.
Very good. And just finally then, Pete, we're almost out of time, but I just want to hear, you know, you are, one of the things I've appreciated about you as I've got to know you is you've got a foot very firmly in the academy, in biblical research, committed to standards of excellence in that domain. And yet you've also got, obviously, your foot within the church, within the spiritual life of a Christian, and you're bridging that, what otherwise too often becomes a divide. How have you managed to sort of draw on research, to increase your passion and confidence in Scripture as opposed to undermine it? What has been helpful for you in that journey?
Well, I do think that it's always good to read the Bible in community. So I learn an awful lot from my own church home group. So although I'm, there as a professional Bible academic who's been doing this sort of stuff for 30 years, I find people who are brand new to the group often teach me things because they come at things with fresh eyes. So I think that can be done. And I think when you look at the question of, say, Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt, you want to look at numerous aspects to it. So you want to study the text. You want to see how actually that's picked up in the New Testament. You want to say, what's the text saying morally in terms of how it isn't good to look back, how it's quite urgent to get out of a place of sin, and God's judgment just doesn't leave time endlessly. But then someone who's got a particular geological background may want to look at what's going on with salt around the Dead Sea, where there's rather a lot of salt. They can look at that from that perspective. And I mean, it is actually, it's interesting, it is in that part of the world. And people obviously sometimes talk about particular things. There's been a paper out recently trying to explain the geology of Sodom and Gomorrah, and it's a very disputed area, and don't expect to sort of understand it all. But if you want to go into details, there are those sorts of things you can go into. But I would say at a very clear level, you've got these four people that God ensures are rescued from Sodom, and all four of them could be rescued, but one of them looked back. And that's a quite alarming sort of thing, that having escaped what seemed to be the worst of it, actually to fall at that later point.
Mm. And no, very helpful. I've actually done a bit of filming myself at Masada overlooking the Dead Sea. And I tell you, the salt is in the air, isn't it? You're absolutely right. It's written into the landscape. But say someone doesn't know that and they want to sort of read a bit more about the backstory, you know, the context culturally in that ancient Near Eastern world. What books or web resources would you point someone to?
Well, I would say, I mean, it's good to read about the ancient world generally, and just to get into ancient Egyptians, ancient Assyrians, and so on. But it is also worth recognizing that for biblical narrative, the best cultural commentary is the Bible itself, in terms of telling you what it was like. And particularly if you're dealing with a city like Sodom, which got destroyed, and so we don't really have the remains of its culture, you're not going to be able to find out much apart from by reading Genesis 19 and so on. So that's where actually the text, I think, is somewhat self-contained in terms of the information that you need to understand what's going on. So I would say that, but it's, yes, absolutely, get a general knowledge of the ancient world, but don't expect sort of golden bullets or whatever that will just make everything slot into place. It's just good to know that the world has often been different from how it now is in many ways, although human nature hasn't particularly changed.
Very good. I love that, Pete. I know you've got many books, but really, you're, as John Wesley famously said, didn't he? Homo unius libri, right? Man of one book. The Bible, just read the Bible, right? And it reveals itself. The more you read it, the more it opens up one passage through another. So fantastic advice. Really great to have this conversation. Dr. Pete Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tyndale House podcast, which was a re-release from the Reading the Old Testament podcast produced by Tyndale House, Cambridge and the Bible Society in 2022. In our next episode, Andrew Ollerton talks to Dr. Roz Clark about poetry and allegory in the Old Testament, particularly in the Song of Songs, which was the subject of Roz's PhD.
Understanding the song to be wholly or mainly about human sexuality happened, or what someone else has called the functional decanonization of the song. That is to say, nobody is literally ripping it out of their Bibles. But in the 20th century, people stopped preaching it. They stopped reading it. But it's such a contrast from the early church and the medieval church and the post-Reformation church, where people preached hundreds and hundreds of sermons on the song, and they talked about it as the most beloved and the most precious book in the Bible, where they most intimately came to know God.
In future series, we will be exploring names in the Bible and the ancient world, and talking in depth to some of the people who study and work here in the Tyndale House Library. Please subscribe to the Tyndale House podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss later episodes. It really helps others to find this podcast if you pass it on to your friends and colleagues, and if you rate and review it.